Welcome to the Independence by Design podcast, where we discuss what it means to be a business owner and ways to get unstuck from the day-to-day so we can design a business that gives us a life of independence. Welcome back, everybody. Very excited for today's episode. I got Joe Brown on the show. He is the founder of Heresy Financial, and he is a top YouTuber on the topics of economic and monetary policy. I am a raging fan, and I go to Joe's podcast to learn about what's going on in the economic machine and how to be thinking about myself, my wealth, and my business differently. I know you're going to absolutely love this conversation. If you want to know a little bit more about Joe, his background, check out the show notes. I'm going to try and keep these introductions nice and short and sweet. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Joe. Joe, how are you, my friend?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
I am so excited for this conversation. There is like a handful of people where like when I stumble across them on YouTube and then like I just like binge their stuff. And you are one of them. So I got a group of buddies that are all entrepreneurs that are all just watching what's going on. And like we just circle stuff around of like, cause we're all working so hard to grow our businesses and then like, you know, keep our money. And then it's like, what do we do with it? And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, look at this guy. He's like telling the truth and he's breaking down the most complicated stuff in such easy ways. Your way of communicating is awesome, dude. And like, and I sit there and people go, well, what do you think is going to happen in the next couple of years? And my brain explodes because like I can see it in my head, but I can't figure out where to start. So why don't you give the audience like, what the heck are you doing right now? And then we can kind of back into the path. And I do want to talk about your thoughts about where things are headed.
That's mostly what I'm doing right now. I pay attention to what's going on in the economy, how the economy works, because I used to be a stockbroker. And when I was a stockbroker, I was really curious first about how the financial system worked, just because the more I learned about, you know, in the beginning about, you know, investing in portfolio allocation and trading, it was like, okay, I'm making more and more and more money. And then you start to realize, okay, there's other things that influence the way that markets work. And you start to get into learning, you know, the mechanics of the actual economy. And while I was a stockbroker, I realized at a certain point, I was kind of hitting the end of the road, trying to dig in from inside of the machine, like the effect of interest rates and the causes of inflation and deflation, what causes the, you know, the business cycle, which is really a debt cycle. And you just kind of run into brick walls. So I started studying economics kind of just on my own, reading books, and found my way to, you know, it was introduced to Austrian economics. At a certain point, I realized, oh my gosh, like I am selling something that I don't believe in anymore, because these things are predicated on a faulty understanding of the way the economy actually works. So in 2019, that's when I quit my job as a stockbroker. And now what I do since then is I just teach people how the economy works, how the financial system works, how markets work, because the more you learn about that, the more you can make more money and protect your money investing the correct way. I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make is looking at symptoms rather than causes. And so looking at the things that are happening that are most apparent, it's like, okay, well, we need to fix that. It's maybe not. Maybe that's just
a symptom. The real problem?
Maybe that's not the root issue. Yeah.
And you do one heck of a good job at breaking this stuff down. And I want to talk about, I want to dive into some of the books and how you got into this. What I mean how you got into this is the stepping stones. Like I read Creature Jekyll Island. Then it was like, and there was like this natural progression. If I were to show you my Audible library, it's like, okay, it was this book, then this book. And I kind of built on it. And I want to get to that. Like you shared on your homepage, like your money dynamic as a family. And I want to hear how that impacted, because you skipped over the fact that you had some money issues as a family that you talked about openly. And then you were potentially, because I was a theology minor and I mentioned that in my video to you. It was like, so like what in you was driving you to understand this stuff? Because when I look at my friends, dude, we're like, I got a D in accounting, Joe. And I'm sitting here going like, how am I the one that likes this stuff? And there's like some weird way of like diving into this that becomes like natural, like breathing. Did that happen to you? And how did that, your past and all that influence you to want to learn this stuff that much?
I would say like number one, it's almost like a flaw of the way that the system works right now, because if you didn't have somebody who is corrupting the money, the only thing necessary to do for financial success would be to learn a skill or a trade, build a business off of it, or work really hard and save and make some very safe conservative investments over your life. And that would be enough. But because There's a constant erosion of the value of our money. We have to learn more and more and more about, we all have to become professional investors. We have to become economists. Yeah. We have to learn how this stuff works so that we can avoid being negatively impacted by those who are, you know, taking purchasing power away from everybody. So I would say it's almost like a flaw of the system. But when you, when your eyes are kind of opened up to that fact that, you know, what's going on, it's like, all right, well, now I have to.
No, wonderful way of putting it, dude, because like that happened to me. And it's like you start pulling that thread. And like Michael Saylor was in this interview a couple of years ago where he talks about like every time that the Fed hits control P, they steal a day of the entire economy. And I was like, oh my God, like it's our time. There, people are stealing our time, which is our freedom. But you pulled the thread to get there. Why did you keep pulling the thread? Because so many people, man, it's like, it's almost like the Matrix where it's easier to be plugged in sometimes. So what gave you the energy to push through to understand the, what you just said?
I'm going to answer that the long way. So when I was young, my parents made a bunch of financial mistakes. They knew they made mistakes, but they still made them. Credit card debt, you know, no budgeting, things like that. They lost, you know, we lost everything in the financial crisis. My parents had a few houses and, you know, lost it all. And so the mistakes, you know, I grew up through were like, you know, hey, there's excess risk taking, there's no planning, there's no budgeting, there's debt. Like, so I felt kind of secondhand the pain of that. And I was, you know, I was fine. Like we were never homeless or anything. My dad never lost his job or anything like
More
that.
More stress than necessary or just
Yeah, whatever. Exactly. And it caused, it actually caused a lot of fighting and, you know, hurt the relationship between my parents. And so like, this is why I say like money doesn't solve every problem, but it does solve every money problem. And most problems are just money problems in disguise. Marriage problems, the number one reason why marriages break up is because of financial problems. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of things that kind of trace
back
to money.
Well, what you even mentioned in your video, like, I mean, health-wise, it's time, right? Because like we need time to focus on the relationships and our health and the things that matter. And if we don't have the time, then money buys time. I mean, at some to some degree.
Yeah. So I went into college to become a pastor. My degree was in Christian ministries, and really, it was just like, hey, I want to help people, and I don't really have any direction for my life. So that was kind of just seemed like the best next step. I did an international business internship over one summer, and my eyes were kind of opened to, if you really want to help people and provide value, the best way to do that is through business. So Gallup did a poll probably 15 years ago, global poll, surveyed tons and tons of people and asked, what's your number one need? Is it food? Is it water? Is it, you know, clothing? The number one response, can you guess what it was?
Money or time?
Jobs. It was jobs. Because people don't, like inherently, people don't like charity. You get sucked into it and you get reliant on it. You become dependent on it. But people don't want that. People want the dignity of being able to provide for themselves. And so going into business and creating jobs, creating value, creating a product and selling it, and you know, in a voluntary way where you're not using the coercion of government, that is creating value, that is creating wealth. And the only way that you are making money in business is by making the world a better place, because you're giving society something it wants more than the money that it's giving up for that thing. That is how wealth creation happens. And the bigger you get, the more people you can employ, and the more dignity you are providing to people who can provide for themselves and their own families, and they are contributing to the world and creating value themselves. And a lot of the problems in the world can be traced back to, you know, we just simply have not created enough wealth yet. So that was kind of the beginning of my journey into business. And I got jobs from there. And I always wanted to start my own business from there. I just didn't have any skills. I didn't know what to do. And so that was kind of the spark that lit the fuse. So that's one side of the story. The second side is I've always been extremely curious. Like when I hear about something that somebody says is true, but doesn't make sense, I literally cannot let it go until I figure out, A, they don't understand and they're wrong, or B, they're right and here's how it actually works. You know, like when I was learning how to drive stick, it was like somebody was just telling me, you know, hey, press the clutch and do this and let off softly. And I was like, I don't understand it. Tell me what's going on inside the engine when I'm doing this.
I'm laughing,
and once somebody could explain it to me.
Dude, I'm laughing because, I mean, I don't know if this has to do with your biblical studies, but like, I was a theology minor and a business major because, like, I mean, honestly, Joe, there's two questions that I've cared about since the first memory, which, why are we here? What's the point? And like, unless for some reason what is being told to me or what I'm doing is fits into some logical understanding, it just like breaks my brain and I have to like go down a path to understand it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of what happened with economics. It was like, all right, I understand how financial markets work, but when people talk about like booms and busts, they just say animal spirits. And it's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Like, what are the mechanics that are driving people to buy at insane valuations and then suddenly turn around and everybody sells everything and now everything's at a discount for years or decades? Like, that's illogical. What's actually happening behind the scenes? And so that's kind of what sparked that, you know, road and learning how it's okay. Actually, it's a debt cycle, and that's caused by the expansion and contraction of the money supply. And so, you know, all the things that, you know, we could talk about if we want.
And I do want to, I want to get into that, because I think one of the things that I want to do with my new show and what I'm doing is that it's not just about creating cash flow with your business, but like there's something, and I'll get to this, but I want to finish this, get to how you had your stepping stone to understanding this big cycle. And but before to give you how I'm thinking in the framework is like Michael Saylor on the Moonshots. I don't know if you've ever seen that before. Michael Saylor was talking about working capital, and that resonated a lot with me. And understanding the cost of capital and when money is sitting on your balance sheet and it's eroding as a liability. And he just actually went through this decision tree as far as like how we have to grow essentially at 8% to cover the debasement. And then another 4% to cover inflation. So every entrepreneur needs to grow at 14% to stay in the same spot, which is insane. And like only how many companies can actually do that? And if we're not, we're going behind. I ended up reading like Creature Jekyll Island, then The House of Morgan, and then like starting to realize that money was like deeper than just like the Dave Ramsey kind of stuff, where I was like, okay, like, cause like I, similar to you, it was like work really hard, provide value and save some money and you'll be fine. And like those rules just don't, I found out the hard way that they just don't apply, but it was like through this thread of like long years of reading these books. So like going from the stock, you know, when you were a stockbroker, what wasn't making sense in that environment? And then what were the stepping stones? And I know, I think you've got on your website, you've got some books that you thought were like the best ones that you've read, but like what ones helped you kind of take that red pill in the matrix to say, okay, there's something bigger here.
Yeah, some of the early ones, Creature from Jekyll Island is great. Ray Dalio's Principles for Navigating Big Debt Crises, that one's a great one. It's interesting because that one, he does a very good job at explaining in technical detail the mechanics of how things work. But he's also like in the book, he's subtly being an advocate for the intervention that really you can see causes some of the problems that he's
McKinsey
discussing.
Almost like coming in with the money printing.
Right. You know, it's like, he's like, hey, this is, you know, this causes problems later on. But in the moment, it's like, this is the right thing to do. And it's like, well, but this has caused the problem. So anyway, that's an interesting book because it explains it well. Peter Schiff has some really great books as well that are like kind of the opposite of that. They're, you know, similar conclusions, similar explanation about how things work. But obviously, he's very like, you know, these are all bad things that shouldn't have been happening. Things like Crash Proof, How the Economy Works and Why It Breaks, I think is another one. The title might, I might have that slightly wrong.
And I can put
so those were a couple of the authors early on that that really helped. Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, absolutely fantastic. So that's a good starting point.
Were you reading those while you were a stockbroker?
Yeah, and that's kind of what caused like the crisis of faith a little bit. Because like I said, I was I got to the end of the road and I was like, you know, I understand how the financial markets work now. I know everything there is to know about retail investing, about trading, about options, about portfolio allocation. My job is to bring assets in the door so the company can make a small fee off of every dollar. We don't really care if, you know, somebody makes money while they're here. And so it was just a deeper curiosity really about trying to figure out, well, why do these things work this way? So one example is like, if somebody comes to me and says, I'm really risk averse, I don't want to lose any money at all. What's the safest thing you can do for me? I'd have to say, I'm going to put you in long-term government treasuries. Okay, well, why do I have to say that? It's because my company tells me I have to say that. And because per FINRA and the SEC, that is, I am licensed and I have to follow these guidelines. And well, look up the chain. It's coming directly from the U.S. government. Well, guess what? I'm telling people to loan their money to the U.S. government. It's like, it might be true, but there's also a pretty clear conflict of interest there. It's like the person at the end of the day telling me I have to say that is the one financially benefiting off of me doing that. And so that was one of the things early on that kind of sparked the curiosity into kind of learning how the economy works and like, are bonds actually safe? How do bonds actually work? What is the relationship between interest rates and inflation? And I remember sitting down with somebody and talking to them about like, you know, the money supply and inflation. And they just looked confused. They're like, money supply doesn't have anything to do with inflation. I was like,
dude, Powell said that like 2 weeks ago. Did you see that?
Right. And it's interesting because back then, this was 2017, 2018, nobody paid attention to the Federal Reserve. Like nobody even knew who the chairman of the Federal Reserve was. And ever since 2020, everybody's kind of, you know, had a lot more interest in it and a lot more education about it, which I think is a good thing. But anyway, so those are a couple things that kind of sparked.
Did you, like, and I want to get into like some of the videos you've been building and like also like where some of this could be headed and what people can be doing about this stuff. But like, I'm just honestly, because I'm just curious, Joe, because of how long I've been down this rabbit hole. And then like, and I'm learning from other people like you, like how you're processing this stuff where it's like, because I was reading these books before like COVID hit and people thought I was nuts. And yeah. I'm sitting here going like, you know what I mean? I'm sitting here going, no. Like there's a different game going on. And I felt like this, like, you know, and because I'm a like deeply optimistic person, Joe. And so like being deeply optimistic and talking about how things are broken over and over and over again doesn't reconcile with who I actually naturally am. And so like, how do you feel now as an individual now that you're able to just talk about this stuff instead of feeling trapped? Did you feel like a misalignment in that stockbroker where you said crisis of faith? Did it just, do you feel like you have to have an alignment of like how you're making your money and what you're doing and how it aligns with the value you're providing?
Yeah, 1,000%. And that's one of the reasons that I started feeling so miserable in my role is because number one, the role was not that fulfilling. It was a sales position, paid very well, but it was very transactional, you know, 200 calls a day type of thing. And at the end of the day, I no longer believed in what I was selling. It's like, yeah, it's probably a little bit beneficial, but there's some way better things that I think you could be doing. And we don't offer that. So we can't talk about it with you. Like if somebody asked about gold, it'd be like, well, yeah, you might get a little bit of commodity exposure in one of the funds that we're going to put you in. And that's, you know, that's about it. That was one of the things that kind of broke for me. And even over the last 5 years, as I've grown this business, well, first of all, I named it Heresy Financial for a reason, because the word heresy, old religious word, means an opinion that's mm-hmm. at odds with what is generally accepted as the consensus. And I found like when you look back through history, like the people who were labeled heretics usually later on are looked back on as like heroes. And they're like, okay, well, they were right. So I use like Galileo as an example of like the like heliocentric versus geocentric model of the solar system. It's like, well, he was labeled a heretic because, you know, whatever. And it turns out he's true. And so that's why I named my stuff heresy, because I did feel like, you know, the stuff that I was saying was generally considered, you know, untrue and potentially even dangerous by the mainstream, because I'm talking about
so
the money supply and inflation, and you got to get some of your wealth into something that they cannot control, like gold and Bitcoin. And so anyway, over the last, you know, 5 years, the way that I have made money and fully believing in that product, that's always been like something that I feel like needs to be in alignment.
Doesn't it feel good?
It's really difficult. Just for anybody who's thinking about, you know, your job or your business or whatever, it's really difficult to act in a way that you believe is fully moral if you are a slave to money. At the end of the day, that's what it is. If you have to do something to get money, it's like, well, I've got to put food on the table. I have to go to work and I have to sell this thing, even though I don't really like it. It's like, that's a very powerful motivator. That's what, if you've ever read Ordinary Men by, I can't remember his name, it's about the 101st Police Battalion in Nazi Germany. They did not want to kill the Jews. They did not want to go around shooting people. They did not want to do it, but they did anyway. It's a brutal, like if you want to understand the depths of depravity, go read Ordinary Men. Anyway, awesome. So just the thing, like I got to put food on table, like you're a slave to money and it's okay, but you got to get out of that. And so the more freedom you can have, which is, you know, measured by your, you know, your wealth and your cash flow relative to your expenses, you're going to be able to make decisions that you feel are more and more aligned. And so in the beginning, I was selling stuff that I believed in. I just didn't like selling other people's stuff. So I'd have sponsorship deals and affiliate deals and be like, hey, if you want gold, go to this company, Bitcoin, go to this company, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, I'm doing as much as possible to make sure that I'm recommending companies that I actually believe in. But I'd rather not do that. I'd rather focus on doing the thing that I feel is most beneficial to people. And so as much as you can, you know, I'm very thankful that I've been able to get away from all affiliates and sponsorships and all that kind of stuff now, and just focus on the stuff that I'm doing now. But there's direct correlation there between your wealth level, your cash flow, and your freedom from being a
and happiness too, right? And like, and I think this is how you articulated that, Joe, is very important for my audience, because that alignment I mean, that's what independence by design is. Like, it's like the designing your, because these are owner operators, right? They're not sitting on that pile of cash flow, moving money around, capital allocator, private equity, and they're not raising money. It's people that started their job, just like my father and I did, or just like I've done three times, for independence, but then you get swallowed up and you're trying to put bread on the table, right? And so, but it's like how to have that alignment is so important to these people, and it's not all about the money. So like the cool part, which you just articulated, is having a job where you can make some income that's truly aligned with your morals and what you want to do, where you don't have some voice sitting over you. And it's honestly, Joe, it's these individuals that are starting to see the writing on the wall of what you're talking about, because it's like, wait a second, I can question the narrative, like the person that owns the HVAC company or the pool company or the commercial cleaning company, or I'm just thinking about just a bunch of my clients. And it's like, you know who can't question the narrative? Are all the commercial bankers or the wealth managers or the CPAs or the McKinsey, you know, all these people where it's like, we just have to bang the drum of how things are, as always will be, because it's what happens to your income or the business model of these companies? So it's just, I think people like you play such an important role that are out there educating people to say, okay, what does this mean? And why is the past not completely like the future is going to be? And I mean, if you go back long enough, like, of course, these cycles happen all over again. But let's talk about, like, where do you start with, like, when you were, this is, I can't wait to hear your response. How do you start with someone when someone says, okay, Joe, what's going on in the economy? Do you get that question? You have this, like, do you give them the whole thing? Do you give them, like, point them to videos? Do you have like a framework or mental model that is like, here's how to think about the current dynamics?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is something that I've kind of, over the last couple of years, has become very apparent to me. Like, I, for a long time, had, I would call it like a savior complex. Like, I want to help people, and I want to do everything that I can to get people going the right direction. It's actually impossible. Like, you cannot change anybody. The only reason, like, if you think back on your own life, the only reason you've ever improved your situation is because you wanted to. And as soon as you are ready, as soon as you made that decision, I'm going to get from point A to point B, you found the information, you found the teacher, you found the coach, you found the mentor, you found the steps, you found the action plan, and you made it happen. And yes, you had to go through pain, but it was because you decided. If you had not made your own internal decision to decide, it doesn't matter what people tell you, it doesn't matter how many people preach to you, it doesn't matter what they challenge you with or how much they shame you or how much they encourage you, every single person has their own internal decision to make. So I don't actually view my role anymore as trying to change people, you know, put people on the right path. It's more of, I'm going to set the action steps out. I'm going to set the information out. I'm the, you know, the wizard hiding in the cave. And if anybody's ready, then they're going to come find me. And, you know, then we'll be able to go together. But it's not something that can happen without, you know, somebody making up their own mind. And so the question that you asked is like, what happened, you know, how do you start? You know, somebody asks you like, hey, I want to learn about the economy, like, you know, how does it work?
Well, they know something's wrong, right? Like, I think that's what's very interesting. Yeah. From like, you know what I mean? Like 8 years ago, where it's like, oh, it's this politician or that politician or whatever. Now it's like, wait a second. We shouldn't all just be able to get free money. And like, why should we, if people are getting free money, do we need taxes? I mean, like, it's been, the moral hazard is like obvious now. So like, let's maybe start with the people that think things are wrong. Like, how do you start explaining to them? Because like, and I want to get where I want to get to, Joe. And honestly, we can go where however you want with this conversation. We're like, we could start at, you know, where I just said of like, how do we understand this? Or all the way to like, I think your video on silent QE by the commercial banks was freaking brilliant. Because I've been trying to figure out how are these central banks going to hide this conundrum that every one of them's in, where there's a bunch of drunk sailors leaning on each other, pretending that this shit's not going down, and how you described it in the, you know, silent QE of the banks was, I'm like, this is how they're going to do it. So like, I don't know how we want to go from point A to point B, and or if we just want to jump into point B and then maybe we do another conversation where we point people into your videos. But like, that's what I'm saying. When I'm in the guts of this, where I think you were spot on with that video, because it's just so obvious of what's going on to me now. So I don't know. I threw all that out there because I want you to feel comfortable taking this however you want.
Sure. One thing that is very, very helpful that I found is the curiosity to help people get to, you know, the root cause. So many people, I think the majority of people widely agree about problems. It's like nobody looks at a homeless person and thinks, that's great. I'm glad they're there.
It's their fault, right? Yeah, exactly.
But no, even if somebody thinks, well, I understand that it's their fault, right? You know, nobody's happy about that. Everybody, if they could press a magic button, would choose to have that person have made different, you know, choices, even if it was their fault, blah, blah, blah. So people just disagree about the solutions. Like, okay, how do we fix this? What's the best way to fix this? But many people actually agree on what the problems are. The issue with that is the only problems that are readily visible are usually just symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so this helps people arrive at the proper solution is by showing, hey, these are surface level symptoms. Let's dig down a little bit to get to the root cause. So a really interesting example of this, there was a clip I saw. It was, I think it was one of the Weinstein brothers on Joe Rogan or somebody. And they made this comment. They were like, you know, it's really, really weird. Something changed in the 1970s. And in the early 1970s, the trend changed and education started exploding in cost. Healthcare started exploding in cost, like nothing we've ever seen before. And that was where the conversation ended. It was like, And so it was beautiful because a lot of the comments underneath that video were like 1971, or the website WTF happened in 1971.
Yeah, right, I've seen that website.
Yeah, it's like, it's just a full, for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's just a full, like long website of a bunch of charts where 1971 is where the trend changed and like something got more expensive or incarceration got worse or the wealth gap got worse or what, you know, something like that. And it's a light bulb moment for a lot of people when they're like, okay, I see what I thought was a problem. It's actually a symptom. And the hard part about it is it does take a little bit of, takes a good grasp of economics when somebody says, okay, we've got Wall Street sucking wealth away from the common person. We've got, you know, so much wealth going into public markets. We've got stock buybacks. We've got unions getting crushed. We've got wages going down while, you know, executives are, you know, increasing their pay by the multi-millions every single year. That's a problem. It's like, wait, it might be a symptom. Let's dig down a little bit. Let's see where that came from. Did greed just get invented 4 years ago? Or did something enable that greed to be leveraged and to be exploited more rapidly than it was right before 2020? And so being able to follow that rabbit hole down, usually you arrive at something like, you know, either a growth of the size of the government or money printing, or, you know, these are usually a combination of the two together.
Amen to that, brother. And you know what I found is one of the most interesting videos I've watched is Jordan Peterson has a biblical series on YouTube. You ever stumbled across that? So his last one, which is in that series, which is like a monologue about Jesus Christ, he actually brings it all the way back. Have you seen that one?
I don't think so.
So Joe, it's so fascinating because I mean, they're meaty, right? Like you're diving into a bunch of stuff there, and regardless of what people think about him, I think he's brilliant in a lot of those interpretations. But why I'm bringing this up is he talks about how, and this is where for me, money became I became infatuated with it. And I want to use what I'm about to say to springboard off into like how you see this problem and what potentially some of the solutions or how people navigate it at the end of the day. If we can't solve it tomorrow because it's just a big machine, what can we do about it? But what I found super fascinating, Joe, is Jordan talks about how like how money, the moment we became conscious and we had to save for the future, like you and I need to like eat tomorrow. And woolly mammoth is like, I can't eat enough of this, so I'm going to give you some, Joe. And then you need to like account for that. So accounting became before written words, I think in Summa or whatever. Like I think accounting literally was first. And then how do we know how to trust that? I mean, money is just stored trust because it was time and energy that was exerted. So it's time at the end of the day. It's stored time and energy is what it is. And so when you look at 71, when you take something and you decouple it from something that everyone agrees upon and it's just fake, like then they can just make it up and you're stealing people's time at the end of the day. So it's just like every one of those graphs that you look at, that's, I mean, essentially what's, there's just such a humongous problem to that. And then the whole narrative is that like we had to do that, right? I mean, I read Paul Volcker's book. I don't know if you ever came across this one, Changing Fortune. Very fascinating. That book was like $800. Paul Volcker wrote it with the Prime Minister of Finance of Japan in that when he, you know, when he raised rates that high.
Yeah.
But like the narrative is like, well, there wasn't enough gold supply and this always had to happen. And I'm like, well, isn't this just bad discipline at the end of the day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying all this because like I've been having that's why I was appreciative to have you on the call, on the conversation, because it's like, am I thinking about this the right way? Like, and there's just so few people to have this conversation with. They're like, hey, this is really what I think's going on. Like, what am I missing here?
Yeah. Okay. I've got a ton of thoughts here. I'm going to try and remember everything that I had coming through my head when you were talking about that. So number one, there's a fantastic book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. It's by David Graeber.
Yep.
He's an anthropologist. I think he might have passed away recently.
I read that way before I knew what the hell I was thinking. So like, yeah. It's been like 15 years ago and I was like, I think I know what he's talking about. No chance I knew.
There's most of the stuff in that book is fantastic. There's some stuff I disagree with, but he does a really good job of showing where, you know, how money evolved over time from a debt system primarily. The thing about time and money, if we want to talk about the Bible for a second, when you look at the creation account in Genesis, that is a picture of perfection. And, you know, it says, you know, God created everything and it was good and it was very good. And in the description of the Garden of Eden, it said there was a river that came in from this one land where there was a bunch of good gold. So even in the creation account of like perfection, gold was there. And, you know, anciently gold was always used as money. So gold is kind of viewed in the Bible as like the money that was created by God versus, you know, whenever debt is talked about, it's like, hey, this is very dangerous. When you want something, when you want money or when you want to buy something, as long as you're not using force or coercion, there's only one way to get something that you want. It's to provide something to somebody else that they want badly enough. They're willing to give you something you want in return. So if you think of two people on a desert island, they know how to climb trees and get coconuts. I know how to fish. I want a coconut so I can drink something so I can survive. The only thing that I have to provide is fish. So I'm going to go get a fish. I'm going to say, here's a fish for a coconut. And then a couple hours later, I'm thirsty again. So I'm going to go grab a fish and I'm going to try and give him a coconut. He's going to be like, I don't want another fish. I'm not hungry yet. There's an example of where barter breaks down, right? Mm-hmm. If you have a third person though, then maybe that third person can get something else of that. Maybe he knows how to make shoes out of leaves or whatever. I have to take a fish, go get some shoes made out of leaves and give those shoes to the guy with the coconuts. And you can see now if there's a fourth person in the economy, this all breaks down. You just can't do that for exchange. So there will be one good that everybody will just accumulate because they know that it has the greatest chance of somebody else taking it for something they want. Over the last thousands of years, that good has become, it narrowed down onto gold. It was the most
durable.
It's on the periodic table. It doesn't rust away. It doesn't decay. And most people will always accept it. And so I don't really want gold inherently. I just want it because I know somebody else will take it. That's why I make jewelry out of it. That's why I use it as, you know, on statues and stuff. It's because it's a sign of wealth because that's where we store the value of our labor. Now, going further from there, if time is the most valuable thing that you will have because you only have 24 hours a day, you can't make more of it. Once it happens, it happens. You can't get it back. So time is the most precious resource that any individual has for themselves. However, your time is the most replaceable thing to anybody else. Because if my employer, if the only thing I have of value is for my employer, if it's time, anybody else can provide that exact same 24 hours because everybody has the exact same 24 hours. So my time is the least valuable thing to anybody else, but it's the most valuable thing to me. The sad part about that is the only thing of value that most people ever have throughout their lives is time. That means they're the most replaceable, and therefore, they have the hardest time storing their wealth, especially when we live in a world where your money, which is you storing the value of your labor, and if their labor is just time, is stored in money, the government's taking from inflation and from taxes every single year, then you are quite literally just being robbed at the fastest rate possible. So,
and people the way to feel escape that, Joe, people inherently feel that nowadays, I think, because of how much the system's breaking. And this is where it's unfortunate with the, you know, Dalio cycle where they talk about the infighting, the geopolitics and all that stuff, because people don't know who to blame. But I think what you're talking about is the real culprit. I mean, you and I are both, it sounds like root system, like root cause system thinkers. And it's the time that's being stolen from them. They don't realize it.
Yeah.
And you said what to do about it. You were just about to launch into that.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, it's very discouraging when you hear that, when you look at that and you're like, man, I clock in and I clock out. I can be replaced by anybody else who clocks in and clocks out. It's like, yes, that's discouraging. But there's a way out, and that just is that you have to find something that you can provide that is valuable to somebody that is not denominated in your time. And that's essentially what starting a business is. Now, when you start a business, many times it will be denominated in your time. Like, you're going to have to put in the work. Like, it's I worked for, you know, 6 months without making
editing videos, right?
And then, yep, exactly. And then another year from there before I was able to make enough money just to pay my bills. So it was a year and a half total before I made enough money to pay my bills. It's like I was putting in 60, 80 hour weeks that whole time. It's like, yeah, my time was worth like zero at that point. But I knew what I was building was something that would be worth a lot more later on. And so it wasn't directly denominated. My time wasn't, I wasn't trading dollars, hours for dollars. And so you have to figure out a way to start a business that you are providing values to somebody that is not, they're not paying you for your time. They're paying you for a product or a service. And once you hit that point, you might not make any money at the beginning, but it's always scalable. You can always scale through technology. You can always scale through media. You can always scale through labor. You can always scale through capital. There's always a way to scale from there once you can separate your earning power from being denominated in your time. And once you do that, now you can escape the fact that, yes, they're stealing purchasing power, but as long as I don't need another hour in the day to make more money, I just need to scale my product or my service, then I can escape that. I've reached escape velocity.
Joe, like, well, and Joe, I'll tell you what, man, I've had roughly three business models I've been a part of. Well, the family business was selling copiers. Then I built up the managed IT and the software. And like, it was equipment. So margins and all the escape velocity was there. I mean, there was such huge escape velocity. I mean, I watched my father just like right off the bat. And that is a lot more difficult these days than back in the 90s, early 90s when he was doing that. But even with managed IT services, I helped convert everything from break fix down into managed IT, where it was scripting and you're automating. So your margins are growing and completely decoupled from labor. But it's so fascinating, Joe, a couple of the businesses I've been in since, it's labor related. And you can feel it, man. Like, there's no, because like, if you think about back to the 8% debasement plus inflation, I mean, your clients don't have enough money to absorb that increase. So even if, like, you know, if you were to say that, like, because I mean, there's attorneys and dentists, I mean, there's a lot of people that trade their time for dollars, but where that, I mean, I don't know what the stat is, and I don't know if you are familiar with it, but like, how much of the U.S. economy is professional services? It's so much. So they like, whether it's accountants or accountants, you know, attorneys, consultants, all these people. And it's like, if that hourly rate model, where are you going to get the money? Because the consumers have to have enough money to give you to handle the inflation. Otherwise, you're literally, those are the people feeling that pinch right there. But to your point, I mean, I think it's a very, this is the business model stuff I want to be talking about now, because like, it's not the same as it used to be, where it might be okay to have like retired off of an hourly rate professional services company where you got to a couple million bucks, and but like you, like that treadmill, just someone took it from 7 to 10.5, and it's very difficult to maintain that.
Yeah, I think it doesn't really, especially in today's world, it doesn't make sense to pursue something that is like an hourly rate type of position, regardless of how high that hourly rate is. Like, if you get paid for exchanging time, you are capped, and it is almost impossible. Like, especially when you take into consideration how much it costs to get into that position. It's like your student loan bills alone are going to soak up the next 35 years of being a surgeon. It's like you're never going to escape, you know, middle class, even if your income is $200,000, $300,000 a year. That's much easier to achieve a very good income with very little upfront cost by starting a business rather than going into the professional services. I will say, though, there's a couple of things about, like, when you talk about if you're running a business and scaling, it's okay if you're scaling through labor. Like, that's scalable. I'm just talking about like your own personal decisions. For instance, the wrong way to do this, when I first hired my team, it was my video editing team. I had always heard, okay, like, outsource the things that you don't want to do, pay somebody else to do it, and you're going to make more money. So I was like, perfect. So once I got my my business up to doing like, I was doing probably at that time around $30,000 a month. I was like, all right, I'm going to hire a team. And they were like $10,000 a month, something like that. And 3-4 months later, I was like, I'm hiring somebody, I'm paying them, I'm losing a third of my revenue, and I'm not making any more money. And then I looked around, I was like, well, I'm just taking the amount of time that I was doing that and I'm spending it with my family now. Mm-hmm. I was like, obviously, I'm not going to be making more money as a result of just doing the same amount of work and paying somebody else to do the other stuff that I wasn't doing. So the like, if you want to actually scale and grow your income, you'd have to replace that time with doing something that actually produces income.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, then you're making a decision. Okay, am I going to pay for a higher quality of life, or am I going to take home more cash and have a worse job? And ultimately, I was like, okay, well, I'm okay now after a year and a half of, barely, having any free time. I'm okay with taking home less money and having more time with my family. And, I found other ways to scale from there. But it's absolutely possible to scale your business, even if that is only done through labor. In fact, many businesses, that's the only way to do it.
Like, I'm tracking to do it. And I specifically think about like the CPA business model is billed 2.5 times the annual salary. And it's clocking hours and they're billing per hour, which is so many professional services firms, that's even more difficult because you're literally cementing your business model into that hourly equation with this inflation and debasement thing. That's all this conundrum. And I think that's where the treadmill is. I mean, you watch EY, you watch the professional services firms, Joe. I mean, they're all struggling because they don't know how they're hiring kids out of college that don't know, have any experience, and they're billing them out at $250. It's like, well, no wonder no one's getting any good services in the middle market. But I digress. I want to go back to like, I think you were honing in on a really interesting question. And then I think this ties in because I want to be conscious of your time here is the next, 15 minutes or so. These owner operators, Joe, have a unique circumstance. Everything we've talked about, it's like, okay, great. Well, the people that I work with, I mean, there's been called 1500 people that have been through my workshops about, okay, the thing that I beat is like owner operators have the ability to grow sustainable cash flow and the cash flow valuation of their company, not some VC hypothetical or some strategic hypothetical sale. It's like grow the cash flow valuation of your company so you can turn around and do an internal buyout, an ESOP, an SBA loan, because your company's cash flow can service that debt. And so that effectively, I like to put is like the rule of thumb is like the $5 million SBA loan came up and it's like, I think what it's 9-10% now, it's $69,000 a month. If you can service that while paying yourself, while paying your taxes and growing the company, that's the cash valuation of the company. But what's interesting, Joe, is I now talk to people who have good businesses, call it like in the professional or the home services or like the stuff that's not like fluffy crap in the economy, but like the real workers of the middle, of America. It's like, okay, if someone gives them, I had two of these conversations this week already. Someone says, okay, Joe, here's like, let's say you own a home services company. Here's $4 million of fiat money, but you're clipping off $500,000 a year in distributions and you've already replaced your job. It's like, well, maybe someone should just hire a key executive for $200,000 and manage it like a private equity firm would, because you could take that currency, that fiat crap, convert it into real stuff. Otherwise, you got to get all your money up front, or because there's so much risk with this additional complexity of what we've talked about with the dollar and the printing. It makes this whole like Monte Carlo simulation of selling your company, how much you get, completely different. Where it's like, what's the risk of the people needing your products or services if there's a lot of struggling consumers? Can you take that cash flow and continue that annuity and convert it into other things? You kind of get the framework. And this is why I wanted to have you on, because like this is the question that people are having is, should I sell my business for $4 million? Or should I hire someone and just step back and then like do something else with that cash flow? And maybe Heresy Financial, I need to dive into that because my wealth manager is telling me to put in the Monte Carlo simulation with 60-40 and exactly what JP Morgan told me. Does it kind of question make sense?
Yes. Yeah. So I've got a little bit more of a general answer for it rather than the specifics, but every investment is a business. If it's not a business, it's not an investment, it's savings. So like gold, that's savings. Stocks, that's an investment. Those are businesses, right? And so on that spectrum, you have passive over here, which is the lowest return. And you have as active as possible, which is going to be the highest return. That's the spectrum that we're looking at. Okay, so.
And it's all based on cash flow statements, to your point. Like every one of those things is based on a cash flow statement, which is fantastic because they're all businesses, actually, to your point.
They are all businesses. The reason why we're looking at that for this specific conversation is because let's say you're selling your business for $4 million. How much income are you taking home from that right now before selling? in our situation.
Let's put some numbers to this, because the example I always use in my training, Joe, is let's do $1 million in normalized EBITDA.
Okay.
Times a 5 multiple. So 5 years of cash flow for that normalized EBITDA of $1 million. $1 million, you call it usually 700 grand in net income. Call it, you know, the normalizations where they're hopefully reinvesting in some of the money, but it's like, you know, they're one-time expenses. So call it 700 grand in net income where you're then paying taxes on that. Minnesota, you're getting screwed. So, you know, you're getting 35, potentially 40%. So like on $1 million in normalized EBITDA, let's say you're doing, oh my God, this is where like, I mean, we build these cash flow statements or I used to, Joe, and I suggest people do it. It's like, what's the trade-offs of reinvesting taxes and distributions? That's the one trade-off. So if you say, okay, on $1 million normalized EBITDA, let's say you're pulling down 400 and then hopefully you're reinvesting, you know, a couple hundred and then you got taxes.
Okay. Let's say you're just taking home 400.
Yep.
And you're going to, or you can sell that business for 4 million.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So that 400 is coming from cash flow. That is not through appreciation.
And not through wages too. Very, very like it's not through wages. This is from ownership distributions too. Like right. Let's assume that, not wages. Okay.
Right. So let's say you do sell your business for four. You're going to have to pay taxes on that, right? Because I'm assuming this is not the QSBC, QS.
Yeah.
It's let's not just a tech assume, company.
Let's say it's a blended of 30%.
Yep. Okay. So you're going to have $3-ish million that you're going to be able to go take, and you're going to have to do something with that, right? Okay, so if we take that $3 million and we put it in a checking account, it's just going to bleed away from inflation. So we're not going to do that. If we put it in a money market fund, we're going to get 5% on that. What is 5% on $3 million? That is $150,000 a year?
Yep.
Okay, so that's worse. Okay, so let's say we put it in the stock market. You might say the stock market can produce 10, maybe 12% a year on average, but that's from growth, which means some years it's down a lot. So when you look at the income from that, you're looking at dividends and you're looking at for the first decade or more, you're looking at maybe 2% to 3% in dividends from a stock dividend portfolio.
And what about the debasement, right? I mean, if you go back to Michael Saylor's talking about like, it's gotta be 14% or 12% to stay at the same purchasing power.
Right. And so if you sell your business and go and invest in public markets, just like the regular way, you are absolutely going to be taking home less money in terms of cash flow from that. It's going to be a lot less work unless you say, okay, well, I want to take home more money from that. So I'm going to try and become a professional investor. I'm going to do a little bit of stuff to try and increase my returns. And that's possible, but that's still work. Right.
Right.
And so then you're like, okay, well, am I going to go and buy another business then? Like, well, then you're entering into a new game. Why aren't you just keeping the business that you have? And so let's say you hate you hate running your business. You've been looking for an exit
customers,
for a long time.
Customers, the
that's
industry.
Completely fine. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like you're getting too old, whatever. Like that's a different story. But all else being equal, the business that you run, you're going to be making more money from that. You have control over it. Yes, it's active. Almost always, you're going to be taking home more money. And if you're not, then it's like, okay, well then, yeah, you should
rethink
do something for less work and more money. But that would be what I would be weighing. And then, sure, if you want to take some money off the table, instead of reinvesting everything back into the business, you diversify a little bit and you start putting some money into, you know, you buy a building here and there, you put some money into public equities, you put some money into some other stuff. But that would be slowly diversifying away rather than a big exit all at once just to get worse returns.
I'm having this conversation with dozens of people a week now. Cause like I've been talking about, I mean, like again, my father and I 10 years ago got an 8-figure wire and it's like, okay, then what? And like, we didn't have any of these plans. I mean, we had no plans, but like now, like, I mean, as I've been focused on this for a decade, it used to make a little bit more sense, especially, I mean, dude, the M&A frenzy, Joe, that I saw over the last 6 years. I mean, you want to talk about multiples and like ridiculous valuations. I mean, I think you're a little bit younger than me, but I was graduating right when the dumpster fire of the economy hit. And like, my dad was buying a house with a check stub. I mean, like that's essentially what's been going on with companies, like with SBA loans or the private equity roll-ups. I'm going, someone has to make this work at some point, right? And so I've been watching this where I say all that because it made a lot of sense where certain people were like, they're like, it's so much money at closing, then I can pile it into other things and it will make sense because the valuation was so much higher. But with interest rates now, now it's like, wait a second, the whole game has changed again. And I'm like having these conversations where it might make more sense to hire someone for 200 grand, put their comp plan tied to cash flow and to debt and to the valuation, and like take less money home, to your exact example that you gave about your own situation, to say you're half in your income, but you freed up all your time for your kind of retiring, but you're able to then have this cash flow. You still have the equity in the business, but I just say this because like how you framed it up is like, it's so important. And that's why I think even like Heresy Financial, what you're doing, like people need, these owner operators are listening. They know that the narrative has changed and they're looking for the truth. And they need to go find someone that is not saying, put it into your, because guess what? You know how many people are chasing the AUM of a $4 million liquidity event? I mean, you probably were too. And like I had a business in that 10 years ago. So these owners are trying to sit there and go like, how do I keep the cash flow and then save? I mean, are you talking like gold, silver, Bitcoin, real estate, commercial real estate, multifamily? I'm like, what are the ways that you would see someone should start thinking about this and the dynamics I just talked about?
Yeah. So this is what I say for everybody. And you can kind of choose how this kind of allocation happens across your own portfolio. I usually like around 30% in savings, and that's gold, primarily Bitcoin, and cash like high yield savings accounts or money market funds or T-bills. And then about 30% in business. And I say business because for some people, you're running your own business. That counts. Otherwise, you're giving your money to somebody else who's running a business. All capital appreciation, all growth comes from business. And then about 30% in income producing assets. And that's primarily going to be real estate. Don't just own land, because that's just going to cost you money, right? You're just going to pay taxes on that. That's not a good idea. It's got to produce income for you. I like physical real estate better than things like publicly traded REITs, just because you get the tax benefits, there's the debt, so you know, the leverage. And so I like about 30% in that. And then usually about 10% reserved for things like speculation, trading, hedging.
Fun stuff, whatever it might be.
I mean, everybody gets into the stage where they're like, oh man, there's this NFT, you know, it's gonna make me rich. There's this stock bubble, there's, you know, GameStop, it's gonna go through the roof. And if you have to pull from something illiquid at a bad time in order to do that, you're gonna get screwed. It's much better to have an allocation for trying to make money with those wild speculation things, that you don't have to be, you know, worried about, you know, what happens if it goes wrong. And so I would say,
dude, it's awesome.
If somebody has all of their money in their business, I would probably just start setting up a portfolio where you start taking some of your income and you allocate it to that kind of a portfolio. 30% publicly traded stocks, 30% savings.
They're not going to get that from a normal wealth manager unless the wealth manager has been unplugged from the matrix, which is why, I mean, I'm getting
well, because they can't make money off of it, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, and there's no affiliate commissions here, but like what Heresy Financial, what you're doing is like people have to take the ownership. It's just like when you go to the doctor, you have to be your own advocate, because otherwise you're getting a fused back or new rotator cuff surgery, you know, without no necessarily needing it. And so I think the incentives and understanding how to balance that portfolio out. And these are the conversations and these are the decision trees, Joe, that every owner operator needs to be thinking about, because it's different than it was before. And these are going to impact their retirement, their job, their time freedom, their actual wealth, their savings. Because like, again, if we're looking at, you know, if 2030, I mean, there's a lot behind this, you know, Dalio and some of these other economists, where it's like the demographic cliff is happening. I mean, dude, when I started this, Joe, I was 27, now I'm 37. And it's like, everybody went from 55 to 65. And it's very obvious to me. I mean, we all just look at what happened with the presidential debate. I mean, like the time is just clipping away. So they need to be thinking about how to store their wealth, savings, true savings. If they can maintain their cash flow compared to their savings, I think going to people like you to say, how do I do that, is going to be important. So what should we be looking for over the next 12 to 18 months? Because I have been talking about on my show, the $10 trillion in US refinancing of government bonds, $1.5 trillion in the commercial real estate. Then there's the zombie $1 trillion in bonds, and everybody's got to refinance. And then there's no public data, but I would bet my life on it. There's $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion of private equity junk out there as well. What the hell's going to happen to this, man? Like, I mean, how are the whatever administration is navigating this? How are they going to pull this off?
Well, as the old saying goes, if you owe the bank $1 million, you're in trouble. If you owe the bank $1 billion, they're in trouble, right? So a lot of small regional banks are in trouble, and it's primarily from the commercial real estate crisis, office space. They're even Powell a couple months ago, just I think it was on 60 Minutes. He just came right out and said, yeah, we're expecting that quite a few small regional banks will fail. And it's no big deal from the system's perspective, because as every account that has under $250,000 or every account with up to $250,000 in it, that money just gets rolled over into the new bank that absorbs the failed bank. Every dollar above that $250,000 per person per bank just ceases to exist. And so
supposedly, this, red SVB flag, if you showed,
yeah, I mean, the only reason why that happened that way is because most of the people had, you know, billions of dollars. And so it was like preferential treatment. It was like, you know, hey, there's not a bunch of little accounts here. There's a bunch of very big accounts here. And so a bunch of tech companies would have, you know, gone under, and they were like, all right, we'll just say it's systemically important and save everybody's money. But that's not going to happen with the small regional bank. So it's like, if you've got more than 250 grand at one bank, you're in trouble. Never have more than 250 grand at any single bank. Spread it out, and then you're fine. So that's a big issue. These banks will fail. People lose their money if they have more than 250 grand in these banks. The price of this real estate will continue to struggle for a long time. Let's see what else. The government rolling over its debt, that is a big issue, but the primary result of that will just be higher interest rates, which means that they have to borrow more, which means—
The doom loop is here though, man.
Exactly.
Like how—
The quantitative easing will return in some form. So there's going to be some form of debt restructuring. Banks will, like we talked about earlier, banks might be released from having their controls on how much U.S. Treasury debt they can own. There'll be something that will happen that will allow money printing to lend to the government. Exactly. At the end of the day, it's all just money printing, though. It's hey, the government needs to borrow more money. They can't borrow it from anybody else. So they borrow it from a money printer, whether it's the banking system or the central bank. And that causes inflation, and then the prices of goods and services go up, and that means interest rates stay higher. So just like happened from 1940 through 1980, interest rates and inflation rise together as the government deleverages. The 1980 through 2020 was the exact opposite. Inflation went down, interest rates went down, and the government levered up. So we're back into that other phase
of
the cycle.
Do you think we can come out of this, Joe? Like, as in, like, because like the reason I struggle with this is like I'm, and again, if we have to have the tap out button because you're short on time, I'm willing to just adhere to this. I could go on for days, and I guess my biggest question is like, because all these people talk about the problem, but it's like, okay, every central bank is screwed. And sure, when you're looking at, and do you follow Rob Paul? I mean, like, I'm sure you've probably do
a little bit, yeah.
Like the everything code, 97.5% correlation with every asset price to the Fed balance sheet. It's like because of the debasement. So it's like, will there shift over? Like we're in, you know, from the Dutch glider to the pound in the 1600s, and then the pound to the US dollar. And like, so there was always this natural, like, well, that economy's crushing it. And now you're just like, it's Bitcoin or gold? Or like, what am I like? Or, and will that happen? And maybe this is a way too big of a topic for our closing statement, but I struggle with, okay, like, is it just like me and my friends and my people that I listen to me is like, keep your company, keep the cash flow, put it into real stuff. And actually my buddies and I have a group called the Ark. I mean, I know Kathy Woods has got that, but it's like, build your Noah's Ark, man. It's going to be stormy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you look at what happened from 1940 through 1980, that's exactly what happened. Inflation went up, interest rates went up, and it was a doom loop. The only way it ended was with a bang. From 1970 through 1980, we had to delink from gold, a bunch of money printing happened, a bunch of inflation happened, and that finally peaked out the cycle. We're likely going to see something like that happening again. It probably won't be 40 years, you know, from 2020. It probably won't go all the way to 2060. It'll probably be a shorter time frame, but we're likely to see interest rates going up, inflation going up, and it all ends with a bang in one large devaluation. That's usually how it ends, with one big devaluation. And that could look like just a full all-out nationalization or monetization of the entire national debt. And the currency is worth a lot less. Now, the thing is, usually at this point, the country who controls the global reserve currency, after that long of a time that like the US dollar has been, it's replaced with something else, usually a stronger, more sound currency. The difference this time is that we haven't had in history a pure fiat system globally
across
up until 1970.
Right.
So there, it is, in that sense, it is different this time. So we don't really know how long the dollar will survive. Like, it can asymptotically approach zero for infinity, right? It just keeps on, you know, it could go 50% lower than 50% lower than 50% lower. Like that's not something that could ever, that would ever have to naturally end. But
and how
but that doesn't
could
mean
be
that
circumvented, Joe, is like, someone puts in like a digital USD and says, by the way, all your benefits and everything comes from this, and they're just managing their own inflation and time conundrum with the government, which is just a total terrifying thought process. But like, how do you process all this stuff as you're thinking about the long term? Because you extrapolate it all. Like, I mean,
this is something that I've probably changed my view on a lot recently over the last couple of years. But in the beginning, it was like, hey, I need to teach people about how this works so that we can try and change a system. But now it's like, hey, we don't have any control over this. It's better to understand how it works so that we can, like you said, like build an arc. Like we can mm-hmm. escape it if we need to. Like even if it literally means escape. Like at the end of the day, the American dream was built on everybody from around the world leaving somewhere that was terrible and coming to the best place on earth. Like that's the American ethos and the American spirit. It's mm-hmm. like if that changes, then the most American thing to do would be to go somewhere else that is much better than than the place that is currently failing. But even if it's not, you know, physically leaving, it's like, hey, put your wealth into something where you don't have to be worried about whether the dollar is going down. You could spend the dollars, you can save in something else. You can build your business, get that income, and invest into real assets that are benefited by that. Like, if you know the grass is greener on the other side of the fence, don't complain about which side of the fence you're on. Learn what you need to do to hop
get
over.
Get on the other side. Yeah, build the other side of the fence. As we wrap up here, I bought a bunch of Bitcoin and gold and silver the last 6 months. I documented the email chain from US Bank. Oh my God. You would have thought I was robbing the bank to get my own money. It was so disgusting of a feeling, Joe. And it just like validated, like, oh my gosh, I need control over my income and I need control over my stuff that I store my wealth in. And it was just, I mean, not to say that I have like the diversification. I like your approach, but eyes wide open, my friend, and you're helping a lot of people. And I have found a lot of therapy in your videos, a lot of education. You do a fantastic job and the value you're providing out in the world is fantastic, my friend. Any final thoughts, or I know, like point people in what direction, what's the best place to continue following you?
I would just say YouTube. On my YouTube channel, it's Heresy Financial. I put out one or two videos a week there and more of what we're talking about here. So if you want more, go there.
Joe, thank you so much, man. I really appreciated it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Joe. I really suggest, if you like this topic, going and checking out his YouTube channel, Heresy Financial. So much good material out there. I just find it so helpful to understand that if I'm going to be waking up and spending time doing things, creating value and storing that value, what game is being played out there and how do the decisions that I can't control impact what I'm doing? Because then I can put what I'm doing into context to make sure that I'm creating more independence over my time. And I think it's worth understanding kind of the bigger framework. And next episode, I am so excited for everybody to meet Roger Roundy, who is the founder of Strategic Associates. He's what I call the missing team member. He does advanced tax mitigation for income taxes like no one I've ever seen before. I've interviewed billionaire family offices, and I'm trying to always figure out what are people doing to mitigate taxes, because there's always a huge line item that we're paying, which is taxes. And what are people doing to legally mitigate taxes in a way that some of the big elites are? And Roger has built a firm where they specialize in architecting a tax solution for business owners and people with high income, so that way they don't have to pay taxes that are above and beyond what is legally obligated. And so I know you're going to enjoy this conversation with Roger just as I did. Thanks everybody for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.